Need one, feel free to take that. Romans chapter 12, I'm just going to read the first two verses. They're very familiar, and then we'll give, this is kind of an introduction to the rest of the book of Romans this morning. So chapter 12, verse 1 says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. All right, with the start of chapter 12, we come in our study to what a lot of people refer to as the practical section of the book. And I'm sure that many of you, whether you've just been reading Romans or listening to these sermons, have been waiting for some practical teaching, because that's what most people are eager to hear rather than what you may think the first part of Romans was, which was doctrinal or dull. I'll just let you pick your own word there. But I think I need to let you know that I don't like that way of dividing Romans to where it's doctrinal in the first half and practical in the second half, because to call these chapters that are to come practical suggests that the ones that came before were not practical. And whenever we find ourselves thinking along those lines, I think we make a mistake that leads to great misunderstanding. You see, doctrine is practical, and practical matters must be doctrinal if it's to be of any help to us at all. Doctrine is practical, and when we get to practical matters, they must be doctrinal if they're going to help us at all. So I think a far better way to talk about this last section of Romans, chapters 12 through 16, would be that these contain applications of the very practical teaching that Paul has given us so far. John Murray, who has commentary on Romans, he's one of the better modern interpreters of Romans. He uses the word application in his introduction to this section of the book. He says, at this point, the apostle comes to deal with concrete, practical application. So he uses both the word practical and application. But maybe you don't like that. I don't. I actually prefer the word consequence. You could say the last part of the book of Romans is the natural consequence of the first part. The late Dr. R.C. Sproul wrote a book called The Consequences of Ideas, where he goes through the history of philosophy, basically, and he'll state the main idea of a particular philosopher and then give you the modern day consequences of that way of thinking. It's an excellent book, and we actually have a few copies of it out here in the foyer. Equipping the Saints bookshelf, and they're there for you to borrow or to just take. And as long as you're one of the first three, you can take a copy of The Consequences of Ideas. I receive a newsletter from Hillsdale College. I don't know if any of you have heard of Hillsdale College, but their newsletter is called Imprimis. And if I remember right, it's been a while since I've read one or even gotten one. I may not have contributed enough to be on the newsletter list anymore. But their slogan used to be, because ideas have consequences. And we've had a lot of ideas in the first section of Romans, haven't we? Truthful ideas, stirring ideas, and ideas that came to pass through the inerrant and authoritative revelation of God's Word. Now, we are going to explore the many important consequences of the teaching that we've already had. But I want to make this point still another way, by referring to a book. It's actually from 1976, but I became aware of it when I was in college. And it's a book by Francis Schaeffer. And it's really his study of the rise and fall of Western culture. And it's called How Should We Then Live? Have y'all heard of that? Did any of you read Schaeffer? How Should We Then Live? I mean, Schaeffer had a gift for using words, and I don't think we can see this anywhere any more clearly than in the title of this book. And the word I want to call to your attention is the word then. How then should we live? It's a very simple word, and we hardly think twice about using it. But when you reflect on that word in How Should We Then Live, it's clear that it is the most important word in this title. Because just suppose that the book was called How Should We Live? Well, there'd be nothing remarkable about that, would there? It's a very common question. How should we live? It's sort of like asking, what shall we do today? Or where shall we eat after church? But when you put then in the title, the question becomes, how shall we live in light of the fact that God has redeemed us from sin's penalty by the death of Jesus Christ and freed us from sin's tyranny by the power of the Holy Spirit? Schaeffer was very clear about where he thinks the West, the Western culture, was headed. He looked at trends such as increasing economic breakdown, violence in all areas of life and in all countries, extreme poverty for many in the third world, a love of affluence, the underlying relativism of Western thought. He saw all of those things, and he concluded that the choice before us was one of two things. It was either total authoritarianism, an imposed arbitrary social order, or it was once again affirming that base which gave freedom without chaos in the first place, God's revelation in the Bible and his revelation through Jesus Christ. Schaeffer's point throughout the book was that those who have received this revelation, those of us who know Christ and have his word, must also act upon it, because that is the very nature of revelation. It demands application. Schaeffer writes this. This will be on the screen. As Christians, we're not only to know the right worldview, the worldview that tells us the truth of what is, but we're consciously to get upon that worldview so as to influence society in all its parts and facets across the whole spectrum of life as much as we can, to the extent of our individual and collective ability. You know, one example you can see of this necessity of the base of our beliefs being on God's word is what has become a cliche of family values. You've heard that mentioned many times. Growing up, it was a big part of politics. And I think it came to the front and the 1992 Republican campaign, because they were trying to paint Bill Clinton as immoral. And so that term came into vogue, really. People like Dan Quayle spoke of it a lot. And quite frankly, I believe in family values. But I must add that today, when you say family values, the political climate is quite different. If we don't have a corresponding belief in God and the acknowledgement of God's existence and God's law and biblical revelation, then these claims, such as family values, just seem to have a hollow ring to it. They seem political and manipulative. I mean, unless we acknowledge God and God's saving acts as the source and the basis of our values, anyone who thinks clearly can refute our concerns with questions like this. What kind of family values are we talking about? A nuclear family? A single parent family? A homosexual family? Why should anyone be preferred above another? Why should we want families at all? So whenever we talk about values, the reply is always, whose values are we talking about and why those? I read a story yesterday. Much of this came together yesterday, which is why I'm not doing a very good job of presenting it to you because it's so new to me. But yesterday I read a story. It was about a bunch of Ivy League educators, which I'm from Texas, so you can imagine my opinion of Ivy League educators. This was in 1987, so this was right after I finished college. These educators got together at Harvard, and Frank Rhodes was the president of Cornell University, and he began to talk and address the group about educational reforms. And he said that we needed to pay attention to values and to the students' moral well-being. Now, you can think, that sounds pretty innocent, but it's not innocent in Ivy League meetings. There were gasps from the auditorium. He had triggered a bunch of people, and this was in 1987. One student jumped to his feet and demanded indignantly, whose values are to be taught? And who is to teach us? And the audience began to applaud. They agreed with this man's questions. And they believed that President Rhodes' address seemed foolish because of these unanswerable questions. In fact, President Rhodes sat down without even trying to answer them. If you go back a generation before that time, it would have been natural for an educator to at least point out the accumulated wisdom of the last two millennia. He could have brought up philosophers like Plato or Socrates or Aristotle. He could have spoke of historians and their work, modern thinkers, and maybe even referred to the Bible. All that, though, has been forfeited, as President Rhodes' capitulation showed. And it's not just that times have changed or that people are skeptical. The problem is, without the absolutes provided by God in His Word, the absolutes of God's revelation of Himself and His ways and His views, everything we think of then becomes relative. There's no real reason for doing one thing rather than the other, except for our personal reasons. And those obviously destroy morality rather than build it up. I think our days have become like the days of the Jewish judges. And you can find out more about them by attending Shane's class in the next Sunday school term, as he's going to be working his way through the book of Judges. But it says that when there was no king, laws had basically been forgotten. And it says in chapter 21 that everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Doesn't that sound like today? If the revelation of God is going to be the basis for social morality and ethics, then it's impossible to have valid, effective, lasting morals without it. And what I'm driving at here is we must have Romans 1 through 11 in order to have Romans 12 through 16. There has to be a basis, a foundation for what we're about to study, and there is. One reformer spoke about this at the start of his lectures on chapter 12. He was comparing Christianity to philosophy. And he said, this is the main difference between the gospel and philosophy. Although the philosophers speak on the subject of morals splendidly and with praiseworthy ability, yet all the embellishment which shines forth in their precepts is nothing more than a beautiful superstructure without a foundation. For by omitting principles, they propound a mutilated doctrine like a body without a head. Paul lays down the principle from which all the parts of holiness flow. Now, earlier, I commented on Francis Schaeffer's book, How Then Should We Live? Or I think it's How Should We Then Live? And I mentioned the importance of the word then. So when we come to Romans 12 here, we discover exactly the same thing here. Only in this case, the important word is therefore. In verse 1, it says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Now, if you've been in youth, college, or adult Sunday school for very much time, or very long at all, you've undoubtedly heard someone lecture you on the importance of the word therefore. That at some time or another, they've told you to pay close attention because it's there for a purpose. The way I was taught it is, whenever you see the word therefore, you have to pause and see what it's there for. And that's, you know, corny sayings like that are really what Sunday school teachers do a lot of times to help you remember things. So that's what I remember. So the word therefore is there, so we should probably pause and see what it's there for. And we've already had a couple of these through our study of Romans. In chapter 2, verse 1, it says something like, therefore, you have no excuse, O man. And it's basically talking about the condemnation of this allegedly moral person because of the failure of the entire race as described in chapter 1. Then we get to chapter 5, verse 1 says, therefore, since you have been justified by faith, and it continues on, and it links the permanence of God's saving work as it's about to describe it in chapters 5 through 8. It links that to the work of God as described in Romans 3 and 4. So we've had a couple of therefores already, but I would contend that the therefore in chapter 12, verse 1, is more significant still. So what does it refer to? When it tells us to look back, what are we supposed to look back to? I mean, some people think that it's the immediately preceding verses, which would be the doxology at the end of chapter 11. Do you think that's what it's referring to? In light of that doxology, then read forward and see what Paul says. Some believe it's in history and he talks about the ultimate salvation of the nation of Israel in chapter 11. Do you think that's what it's referring to? Because of all that, therefore, let's move forward. Maybe it goes all the way back to chapter 8, where it says that nothing on heaven and earth will ever separate us from the love of Jesus Christ. Therefore, present your bodies a living sacrifice. Maybe we go back even further, chapters 1 through 4. The doctrine of justification by faith. That's pretty important. Because of that, therefore, present your bodies a living sacrifice. And there have been defenders for each of these views. And each can be defended with very good arguments. Here's one possibility. One summer, I read this yesterday as well. One summer, a Jim Boyce, he was a pastor in Philadelphia, I believe. He'd been teaching the book of Romans to a group of leaders from Bible Study Fellowship. You've heard of that group. And after he did that, he received a letter from a woman who thanked him for the series and explained how she had come to understand the importance of God's grace in election for the first time. She wrote that for years she had considered election strange and dangerous, but that her eyes had been opened. She wrote, quote, "Not only was my mind opened, but my heart was touched. The tears were impossible to restrict several times as I realized what a privileged and totally undeserving recipient of His grace I am. I can hardly believe what a gift I have received from Him. It truly brings me to say yes, yes, yes to Romans 12, 1 and 2. It's the very least and only rational thing we can do in light of God's unimaginable gift," unquote. So this woman was moved by the doctrine of election, which is chapters 9 through 11 here in Romans. But I think the answer to what does the therefore refer to is that it probably refers to everything in Romans that precedes it. Everything we've read from chapters 1 through 11 is in mind as Paul moves forward. So let's go back to chapter 1 and start over. I'm just kidding, we can't do that. You can go back and listen to the sermons if you want. They're on the website. Charles Hodge said this, "All the doctrines of justification, grace, election, and final salvation taught in the preceding part of the epistle are made the foundation for the practical duties enjoined in this section." I mean, that's the way Paul has worked in other books. In the book of Ephesians, the first three chapters are doctrinal. And they're followed by three chapters that deal with things like spiritual gifts, morality, relationships, spiritual warfare. That's in Ephesians. When you get to Galatians, the doctrinal section is in chapters 3 and 4. And that's followed by chapters 5 and 6, which speak of Christian liberty, spiritual fruit, love, and the obligation to do good. Colossians, the doctrinal section is in the first couple of chapters, and then the application is in the rest through chapter 4. And the same pattern occurs in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. It's also in 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Philippians, although it's not as obvious there. I mean, it is Paul's way of doing things, but strikingly, it's not the way of the other New Testament writers. When you look at people like Peter or John, they don't teach that way. It's very much a characteristic of Paul. It's fundamental to Paul that a justified man does not live in the same way as the unrepentant sinner. That's what Paul is moving toward. So, if therefore is a linking word, linking something behind with what's to come, we've already looked back to see what it's referring to. Now we should look forward to see what the doctrinal matters of chapters 1 through 11 connect with. What's to come? So what I'm going to do in the next 10 minutes is break down the remainder of the book of Romans into 7 sections. That does not mean that we're only going to have 7 more sermons. It just means 7 sections. I'm only written a couple of sermons, and they're still in the first section. But 7 sections to the book of Romans from here forward, starting in chapter 12. The first is applied Christianity, and that's the verses we began this morning, verses 1 and 2 of chapter 12. If God is the basis of reality, so that everything flows from Him and takes its form from Him, remember it says, "For from Him and through Him and to Him are all things." If that's true, then our relationship to God is the basis for our other relationships. And our duty to Him is the basis for all of our other duties. Because this is so, Paul sets out principles that should govern our relationship to God in these first couple of verses. And we're going to jump into those when we get to them, my next opportunity to preach. Paul reminds us that we're not our own, and we should therefore present ourselves to God as willing and living sacrifices. That's the first section of Romans. The second is the Christian and other people. The most challenging section. Chapter 12, starting in verse 3, going through verse 21. The Christian and other people. I mean, there are three basic areas of application for the gospel. And they each involve relationships. I mean, the first two verses of this chapter, the one we read today, outline the right relationship of a Christian to God. How do we relate to God? But starting in verse 3, we're going to see the other two, the right relationship of a Christian to himself. We're going to learn things like we're not to think of ourselves as more important than we really are. We're to be humble. And then in addition to that, we're going to look at the right relationship of Christians to other people. The first of those two is briefly treated in verse 3, and the rest is verses 4 through 21. The third section of Romans is the church and the state. You see, it's not just individuals that we have relationships with, it's institutions as well. And one institution is the state. So what is our relationship to the state supposed to be? Are we to oppose it? Because, I mean, it is an incorrigibly secular and godless entity. Are we to try to escape from it? Or are we to submit to it? And if we are, is that submission to be without any qualifications, regardless of what the state may ask us to do? Are there any limits? If there are limits, what are they? I mean, we know from history that these became very important matters for many of the early Christians, especially in the years where leaders of government persecuted them and tried to abolish Christianity. Paul answers many of these questions in chapter 13. And he provides a pretty strong case for the validity and the worth of secular government. So that's the third section. The fourth section you can call the law of love. That's verses 8 through 14 of chapter 13. I mean, Jesus has already defined for us that the sum of morality is basically this: to love God with all of our hearts and minds and souls and strength, and to love others as ourselves. Paul seems to reflect on this teaching of Jesus many times in these chapters, and he unfolds what that means in this section, the law of love. The fifth section is Christian liberty. This is perhaps the most interesting one, so it may be the most difficult to preach. I don't know. We'll see. I haven't gotten there yet. And this is also the longest of these sections of the final chapters of Romans, but it concerns Christian liberty. And at first glance, that may seem surprising when you think of all the cultural problems that existed in Paul's day. I mean, have you ever wondered, why did Paul not condemn slavery? Why didn't he develop a Christian view of economics, or maybe comment on war? I mean, we like to argue about that stuff. Wouldn't it be nice if Paul had lined it all out for us here? And I don't know with any certainty, I don't know that anyone can know, why Paul chose to ignore those matters and address other ones. But his decision to deal with personal liberty, at least, indicates how important this matter was for him. So, in a nutshell, he does not allow Christians to disobey God's moral law, and he does not offer a low standard of ethics. So we're not going to compromise. The standard is the highest, the yielding of our entire selves to God as living sacrifices. Remember, that's in the verses we read today. But Paul was nevertheless firmly opposed to one group of Christians imposing extra-biblical or even non-biblical standards on other Christians. I mean, we see this in the letter to the Galatians. He defends the believer's liberty there. And he tells really how strongly he felt about it. He used words like, stand firm in the liberty Christ has given you and do not be burdened again by the yoke of slavery. That's in chapter 5, verse 1. So, Christian liberty is section number 5. Number 6 is Paul's personal ministry and plans. So, after he discussed this Christian liberty, personal liberty section, he drops this ethical advice and he writes of his future plans. In these verses, he picks up on matters that he introduced at the start of the letter and explained that he wants to come to Rome. He explains why he's been hindered from coming to Rome and what he hopes to receive from the Romans when he gets to them. So it's more personal ministry kind of stuff in that section. And then we move to section 7, and that's his final greetings in chapter 16. Many people overlook this because they see it as just a list of names, but it's very much more important than that. The names reveal much about the churches in Rome and in Corinth. They show how involved Paul was with the individuals who made up these early Christian communities. And they show that Paul himself practiced the concern for others that he'd been urging us to practice all along. So you could say that we're about to plunge into this great forest of these remaining chapters. But if you're going to use that analysis of jumping into this great forest, I want to tell you we're going to be analyzing very closely the trees. But in this series of sermons, we've also been doing something else that I think is very valuable. We've also been looking at the forest. The bottom line of our study is that truth as a whole. Since we're talking about God's saving work for us, that means that everything God has done for us in salvation has a bearing on what we should do in all of our life. We must be different people because God has saved us from our sins. You want to answer the question, how should we then live? In response to everything we've learned in the first 11 chapters of Romans, we should be different people. Not just because of what we know from Romans, but because God has saved us. I found a Gallup poll, and I apologize, it's from 1982, which is a really, really long time ago. That's when I graduated high school. The high school I graduated from is not even a high school anymore. But in 1982, George Gallup organized a poll, and I looked for a newer version of this, but I didn't have a lot of time. I didn't find anything. And what he did was he organized or developed a scale to sort out those for whom religion seemed to be important from those who didn't see it as important at all. You see, America claims to be a very religious country, but the nation is increasingly immoral. This was 1982. Gallup really wanted to know if religion made any difference at all in people's lives, especially in the lives of those who consider themselves to be highly spiritually motivated. That was one of the groups he created for this poll. And you could select highly spiritually motivated, or you could say committed. He found that 12.5% of Americans fell into that category. One out of every eight. And he found that those people really were different. So much that he called them a breed apart. He found that these people differed from the rest of the population in at least four areas. And as I go through this very quickly and close today, I'm going to invite our musicians back to the front. The four ways that Gallup saw that these people were different, that were highly committed to Christian ways, was they were more satisfied with their lot in life. They were happier. 68% said they were very happy. Can you imagine that today? 68% of people stated they were very happy. Those people were in this group that were spiritually motivated. Only 30% of those who were uncommitted answered very happy. The second way they were different was their families were stronger. The divorce rate among this group was far lower than among the less committed. Third, they tended to be more tolerant of persons of different races and religions. Isn't that the opposite of what we're accused of today? Fourth, they were more involved in charitable activities than were their counterparts. Total of 46% of the highly spiritually committed say they are presently working among the poor, the infirm, the elderly, such things such as that, compared to only 36% among the moderately committed, 28% among the moderately uncommitted, 22% among the highly uncommitted. So twice as many as the uncommitted were involved in charitable activities. The reason I give you this is just a very simple truth, and that is that true conversion makes a difference in a person's life. If there are no differences, there is no genuine conversion. Now, don't misunderstand me. You're not converted because of the service or the happiness or the other things that Gallup mentioned. They are the result, not the cause. But true conversion makes a difference in a person's life. And if there are no differences, there is no genuine conversion. These differences we're talking about are going to be explained in the remainder of the letter to the Romans. You see, laws in themselves change very little. Changed people change everything. And the only thing that ever really changes people is God Himself through the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. So if you've been called to faith in Jesus Christ and you're part of a radically changed community of faith, and it is your privilege to begin to make changes in your world by exhibiting those differences that a converted person will have. So we'll explore those in the weeks ahead as we continue through the book of Romans. Would you pray with me?